We'll proceed to the third case of the day, which is Pittman v. Madison County, number 12-3233. Mr. Anderson.
Yes, sir.
May it please the court, Ross Anderson for Plaintiff Reginald Pittman by and through his mother, Robin Hamilton. Your Honor, the plaintiff is in a vegetative state. It's secondary to an attempt to commit suicide by hanging from a Seg 3 isolation unit, which was an isolated two-cell unit where the inmates couldn't see each other and where there was absolutely no video monitoring, where there were bars, and where there was all sorts of equipment that could be used for suicide, and where there were not other people, as if it had been in GPOP, who could warn guards that there was a problem. In addition, the situation was such that it's separated by a closed door in a hallway, and there is no way, other than through regular rounds, that he can be seen. We have, and we believe that we've established in the trial court, and we object to the findings of the trial court for summary judgment in favor of the defendants in toto, deliberate indifference of the policy and procedure of the policymakers, and I don't believe that there's any dispute, at least that Sheriff Hertz, Madison County, and Superintendent Goulash would be the appropriate policymakers in establishing essentially ineffective and improper procedures for impact in suicide prevention. To begin with, the policy itself, which we have presented to the court, is ineffective. It simply states that if a guard has a concern, he should report that concern to his supervisor, and the supervisor should then contact crisis. It's important to note on the record, and the trial court did not note it, that there were no psychological or psychiatric services that were available at the jail. Essentially, they had withdrawn for liability concerns. The issue then is that they had these counselors through crisis. But the crisis set up at the Madison County Jail was substantially different than it often is at other jails and at jails where there are psychological services. In essence, at Madison County, and I think one of the issues that we have raised about education and training is apparent in that the defendants did not in any way in the trial court attempt to present their policies and procedures that they followed in writing. Rather, they attempted to present them through the oral testimony of their superintendent. The sheriff purported to be ignorant of all issues surrounding suicide prevention. His testimony was that it was not even a particular problem in the jails as far as he knew, and he took a bottom-up approach and felt that the jail superintendents, Defendant Goulash and Captain Bunn, and the doctor, the medical director, and the nurse, Unfried, would bring any of these issues to him, and therefore he essentially had no knowledge whatever of how the policy worked, and he relied on others. Captain Goulash testified that the policy was substantially different and different than it is portrayed in the trial court's judgment. What Captain Goulash said was if there is any reference or request for crisis, and it's important to note that the written policy doesn't maintain any mention at all of what's to be done if the prisoner himself actually requests crisis. And Captain Goulash says, if that's to be done, What must happen is there must be an immediate follow-through if it is anything other than a frivolous request. And Officer Warner characterized a frivolous request as being one where they just want to see crisis because they want to see a pretty face or a girl or something along those lines. Warner, Defendant Warner, who was the officer there, and Defendant Eaton both agreed with that. Now, the interesting thing in this case is, first, the policies and procedures were presented by Captain Goulash in an oral fashion. Here is what to be done. Here is what's to be done. The written policy, where you're supposed to contact a supervisor, is never followed by anybody. More importantly, the education that is provided to the officers is a 1 hour to 2 hour video, which is we've attached the bullet points as part of our record. And that video doesn't talk about anything whatever about the hands-on actions that are supposed to be performed by any of the officers once a crisis request has been made. The only thing it does say, if you're concerned about suicide, well, then you contact your supervisor, and it doesn't talk directly about crisis. Now, what was actually done here is Defendants Eaton and Defendant Warner actually testified. And we're relying, of course, on the testimony of witness Bradley Banavese. This is a two-cell isolation unit, and Banavese is next door. And Banavese testified that Mr. Warner came in on December 14, and that, which is 4.5 days or so, 5 days before the suicide attempt. And Mr. Pittman requested that Officer Warner refer him to crisis. And Officer Warner, unlike any other reported case that I've ever seen, said, sure, I will. Now, in the context of the Madison County Jail, crisis is the last authority. Nurse Suda, who is a crisis manager, has testified that the only reason it's out there is for suicide prevention. Every witness who has testified said the crisis has its usual meaning in that it is an emergent situation that requires immediate response. If witness Banavese is to be believed, first off, he immediately recognized that Officer Warner was lying. Warner said, I'm going to do it on Monday. And Banavese actually confronted him that evening and said, hold it. I know the schedule. You're not working on Monday. You're not going to do anything here to this man. And Warner actually then, according to Banavese in his words, blew him off. Just left and let it go. Then, according to Banavese, thereafter, and according to Stevenson, according to every professional witnesses, the crisis intervention people out there, if Warner then didn't take some action, something, he was guilty of deliberate indifference. And what did Warner do, according to the record, is nothing. They defended this case on the basis in their depositions that Banavese is lying. What Warner himself said, it would be deliberate indifference if I did this. And what happened is he did nothing, nothing at all. Then over the course of the weekend, Pittman is alleged to have been crying, to have been upset. And once again, according to witness Banavese, every guard who came into contact with him was requested now, where's crisis? And there was no writing or anything put in the log to let them know that indeed Pittman had requested crisis. What took place then is after 4 or 5 days of this, and now, according to Banavese, 6 to 10 shifts of uncontrollable crying, weeping, all known to witness Eaton and all of the guards who are present, and according to witness Banavese, all are aware of his problems, of a death of a family member, of a girlfriend who is now unfaithful, and of unsure contact with his family because he has now been placed in isolation and he's not allowed visitation because of a change in the rule and some confusion there. Everybody's aware of this, according to Manabees. And what happens then is, after 6 hours of crying, 6 hours of difficulty, he again requests crisis, and again nothing happens. There is absolutely no evidence. One of the things that's happened is Sheriff Hertz has testified, well, what you do is it's a balancing test and it's a common sense test. And the truth of the matter is that has been specifically rejected as an appropriate approach, at least at the district court level, in the Foster and Philadelphia case that I cite. They had a much more intensive program, and one of the officers came in and said, well, I didn't understand it, and I just used my common sense, and that in and of itself was found to be, in the Foster case, evidence of deliberate indifference. What happened then is Eaton ignored it, and then later that morning he's in the cell, and Eaton doesn't put in a request of any type or nature, and both Eaton and Warner say, I know it didn't happen because I have no record, because I would usually follow Captain Goulash said is the policy and procedure. And, in fact, nothing was done, and he committed suicide by hanging. Now, the broader approach that has been taken by our expert, however, is that the entire...
You would please stay close to the microphone.
Right. The broader approach that has been taken by our expert is that the entire process here, when taken together, is in error, and that the number of suicides that have occurred at Madison County Jail, where now we have 40 or so that were disclosed in summary, I've recently become aware of two more. My expert says that, hold it, it's not the type of analysis that's usually contained in this court where you have a comparison between the local area and the jail itself, but he says, I've got a similar jail, and this is 13,500% greater. I've had four such issues over 20 years with a much higher population, and the jail has had 40 over the last 5 years. The jail itself in discovery, I had to get these through the state. They say we don't keep them. We don't know what they are. It would be burdensome to know, and they don't do any at all quality assurance or critical incident debriefing. What happened to my client here is 2 years earlier he had been diagnosed with a mental condition. The district court actually found that the counselor had become aware of this, but that's false. Her testimony was very dramatic. She said, there were no records, there's no records out there. I called down to my home office, and they tell me the psychological issues are clean. So she makes a recommendation to go back to GPOP. Everybody else but this counselor says a GPOP is a specific recommendation. He comes back again on October 31st. Now this thing is missed. The initial questionnaire, by the way, is bad. If the court examines that, it doesn't talk about prior suicidal ideation, and it counsels the illnesses on treatment, hospitalization, I believe, and then also on diagnosis. But this guy's got poor insight. With respect to what happens then is, and there's no reference to this at all in the district court, on November 1st, after he is being released back to GPOP, which was eventually violated as well, he is given he is ordered, according to the law, to be put back in SHU. So according to this record, he is supposed to be in a supervised housing unit undergoing special housing. Now, all of the crisis records have disappeared. Nobody knows where they are. With respect to the records that were sent to the enforcement agencies, the logs were redacted. So there's nothing to reflect in the logs that are sent to the enforcement agency that he was sent. He was first shackled when he was out, and then he was sent to SEG without any additional review by crisis or by anybody else. So the expert testimony is, and I mean really on November 1st, it's almost laughable. We have a situation here where the medical staff issue psychotropic drugs as sleeping pills. We have an LPN who is doing clinical assessments, who is not qualified by licensure otherwise to do the clinical assessments. She's the one who issues the psychotropic drugs.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson.
All right, thank you.
For the defense, Mr. Gilbert.
May it please the court. Your Honors, this is a tragic case. Mr. Pittman is in a persistent vegetative state. However, under the case law of this circuit, summary judgment was not error. The record not only suggests that the individual defendants were not deliberately indifferent, but also in the Monell claims, the summary judgment was appropriate. In 2006, this court issued a decision in Collins versus Seaman. That case set the standard for liability with respect to deliberate indifference in jail suicide cases or attempted suicide cases. And it's beyond argument that that standard is that with respect to individual liability of the jail officers, the sheriff, Goulash, and the medical personnel, Dr. Blankenship and Nurse Unfried, that they had to be on notice of an imminent, substantial risk of suicide. The record in no way supports that conclusion.
Nurse Fillman was your expert, right?
Correct.
And if I recall correctly, she said that if, in essence, there was an oral request, I need crisis now, and a deputy were to ignore that, that would be deliberate indifference, right?
That's what she testified to.
That's your expert.
Correct.
And said the same thing if there was a request for crisis intervention and the deputy said, well, I'll get to it on Monday and did nothing. That would also be deliberate indifference.
And that's what she testified to.
Okay. Why isn't that enough to present a genuine issue of fact here with respect to Warner and Heaton?
Well, here's why, Your Honor. Because she is not qualified to give a legal opinion as to what constitutes deliberate indifference. Plus, the defect in her testimony, and the district court, I think, recognized it without referring directly to her testimony, is that even if you believe Bradley Banov's testimony,
which we must, correct? You move for summary judgment, so we've got to believe it, right?
And I have no quarrel with that. I would agree, Judge.
Okay.
But here's the problem. If you apply the Collins standard to Banov's testimony, there is no testimony from Banov that Pittman ever mentioned suicide other than to joke with Banov about it.
Right. Let me ask you about this, though. These are obviously difficult problems in managing jails. Let me shift away from the mental health context.
Sure.
I'm drawing on a case that I dealt with as a district judge some years ago. A prisoner had a badly infected leg, could have been treated, didn't get the treatment it needed, and eventually the leg had to be amputated. Now, I don't know that anybody would have recognized just how serious the consequences could be, but the infection alone was a serious medical need, and there was indifference to that. And then it turned out the consequences were devastating. I'm wondering if that kind of analysis might apply here to those requests for crisis without mentioning suicide. Your witness says that would be deliberate indifference, and then the prisoner spirals out of control and eventually tries to commit suicide.
Your Honor, I think the answer to that question is found in the Collins case. In the Collins case, this court stated that a request to see a crisis counselor standing alone is not sufficient to put a defendant on notice that an inmate poses a substantial and imminent risk of suicide.
Right.
Is it enough to indicate there is a serious medical need, as your witness testified?
I don't believe so. Not under the standards.
As the plaintiff's experts testified.
Correct. Not under the standards of Collins, I don't believe. I think the Collins court, this court, made it clear that, and as they, as the court said later on in the opinion, a deliberate indifference standard imposes a high hurdle for plaintiffs to overcome. I think what the court was saying in Collins, I think the court says this in Collins, is that in order to have liability for an attempted suicide, the individuals who are sued in their individual capacity have to have knowledge of a substantial and imminent risk of suicide. Even if you believe Banov's testimony, which, as you say, Judge, you must, because we're here reviewing a summary judgment standard, we don't have any indication from Pittman that he is at substantial imminent risk for suicide. He wants to see crisis because a family member died. He wants to see crisis because his girlfriend is being unfaithful. Banov says he's crying. And the only reference, Judge, to suicide in the discussion between Banov and Pittman is Pittman jokes about it. Banov even says that.
What do we do about, is it Captain Goulash? Is that
Goulash was the jail superintendent, yes.
What do we do about his testimony to the effect that, in essence, if there's a request, even an oral request, for crisis intervention, there's supposed to be an immediate response?
Well, I think the record shows that in every other occasion that the request for crisis was made, they immediately brought crisis to Mr. Pittman. I would say that if there was...
But not this time.
Not this time.
Not on the 14th and not on the 18th.
Correct, because suicide was not mentioned.
Was suicide mentioned for the other requests? I thought your whole case was that nobody had ever mentioned suicide, and yet there was this immediate response.
That's correct. Other transactions he had with Chestnut, who was providing the crisis counseling, he strongly denied suicidal ideation. If in fact there was a request to that Banov says he requested to see crisis.
We must assume that.
And you have to assume that. The fact that the jail superintendent says it's deliberate indifference, I believe, he may say that. I think he was a little more wishy-washy than Mr. Anderson would have the court believe, because he actually didn't say, he said it was, it could be deliberate indifference or negligence. If you look at his actual testimony, he wasn't clear. He said deliberate indifference or negligence, something to that effect.
Well, it's pretty unusual for a defense witness to be saying, yeah, that could be deliberate indifference, right?
It is, because, you know, they're not qualified to make that determination.
Who is?
The courts. It is the only qualified entity to make the determination of deliberate indifference, in our view, would be the district judge who made that determination, or this court who reviews de novo, can make that determination. If lay witnesses...
A jury to decide it, right?
A jury as well, yes, Your Honor. I'm thinking in the context of summary judgment. But, of course, a jury can make that determination. But I believe that under the standards of Collins, that it's inescapable that if, not in a standard deliberate indifference case like the one that you were making reference to about the bad leg, but we have a case that tells us that in a case of suicide or attempted suicide, they have to subjectively know that there is not just a substantial risk of suicide, but an imminent risk of suicide, which I would suggest has not been met in this case. Now, on the Monell aspect of the case, which is, I think, where Mr. Anderson spent most of his time, I think there is one huge hole in that case. And the huge hole in that case is causation. There is no evidence on the record below that links all of these defects that Mr. Anderson cited to the court and that his experts talked about with the harm. There is no evidence at all linking the fault, if you will, with the injury. He talks about, you know, we do have a written policy, that's clear. The testimony of the witness makes it clear that there is a, maybe not a specific program for suicide prevention, but the guards are trained. We have a written policy. All of the witnesses talked about when requests are made, crisis is brought in. Even if you accept the premise that the policies are somehow defective, there's no evidence on this record that links those policies, which he alleges are defective, with Reginald Pittman's attempted suicide. There is no link between what he believes is fault and the injury that occurred.
Why isn't that link pretty obvious? Where if the policies described by plaintiff's expert had been in place, you'd have, in essence, a much quicker trigger. Might be a good thing, might be a bad thing. There's room for debate about that. But a much quicker trigger on bringing in psychological intervention, putting in place suicide watch provisions, and so on. Isn't that a pretty foreseeable consequence of the kinds of policies he's talking about and the suicide attempts are a foreseeable consequence of their absence?
With all due respect, Your Honor, I would say no, because there is an absence of record evidence linking this. I mean, it would be speculation to say that any individual commits suicide because we don't have a written or that we don't have a suicide prevention policy as Mr. Anderson would have us in the jail. I think that there, and he talks about these 39 suicides. His own evidence indicates that 8,000 inmates a year go through that jail. In 5 years, he talks about 39 attempts in 5 years. That's 40,000 opportunities for suicide. 39 attempts are made. That is an infinitesimal percentage, if you do the math. And without more, you can't just take a number of suicides. You can't just take a phenomenon and say, okay, this happens here. That's what led to Reginald Pittman's suicide attempt. Your Honor, I think there has to be more. And that's what's missing with respect to the Monell claims. Maybe the policy, maybe he cited some problems with the policies, but what is not present in the record is any testimony, including expert testimony, statistical evidence, anything, that links this alleged fault with the injury that took place. So we believe that certainly without that causation, without that evidence of causation, his Monell claims have to fail. I think Judge Herndon recognized that in his opinion, although he didn't say it specifically, but I think he recognized that there was no causation. He actually stated that based on the evidence, his review suggested that they didn't identify an unconstitutional policy or practice. And I think that's an important point, too. What he has criticized, and by the way, I don't think it's completely supported by the record, but what he has criticized are issues that do not rise to the level of an unconstitutional policy or practice. The fact that they don't like our training doesn't mean it's unconstitutional. The fact that they don't like that we don't have a psychiatrist on staff, I know of no case that requires that, but the fact that we don't have a psychiatrist on staff, there's no evidence that that's an unconstitutional practice. So I think I would agree that Judge Herndon was right in saying, really, they haven't identified any practices or policies or customs, to put it in Monell language, that are unconstitutional. And as a result, we believe the Monell claim has to fail. I would... thank you, Your Honors.
If you want to wrap up, go ahead. I'm going to give Mr. Anderson another minute for rebuttal.
No, Your Honor, I think we've covered it. Thank you very much.
Gilbert. Mr. Anderson.
Judge, in response please,
if you could wait till you get to the microphone. We're making a recording, so you should stay within literally shouting distance of the microphone.
I'm here now. I just wanted to say a couple of things. First off, I have listed all of the causation instances that occur in the record on page 36, and one of the most significant is that the guards themselves indicated that if they were aware that an inmate was depressed, that that would affect how they would respond to crisis. The practice of the jail is psychological custody, the medical don't talk to each other at all. And furthermore, even if they did, it wouldn't do any good because they don't use diagnoses when they give medication. So there's nothing that anybody could know. And Blankenship believes he's supposed to be part of this process. He believes that the guards are his line of defense and monitor for him. And the guard says, nobody tell us. We never do that. We're not qualified to do that, and we don't do it. It is almost a Keystone Cops situation with respect to what's going on here. And Nurse Unfried said, I guarantee you, she didn't say I guarantee you, she said there are not enough resources here. I want to shift briefly to the state claim because Banavies said, I told an unnamed guard, now I can't make that case under deliberate indifference in the Constitution, that he was suicidal. Now, that's an objective willful and wanton standard in the state case, and there can't be a stronger willful and wanton case. I told the guy that he's suicidal, and they did nothing.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson.
Thank you.
Okay. The case is taken under advisement.